You know, you have been incredible at bringing new people to church these last 8 weeks, and I really, really commend you for bringing your loved ones and trusting us with your loved ones. And bring them back next week. Those who come, those whose seed is being planted. What I felt the Lord was putting on my heart at the beginning of this festival, plant the seed in the summer and you reap it in the winter. So seeds that are being planted, people that you brought, don't be despondent. Because you cannot sit in this atmosphere where God comes and resides and rests and moves in the midst of his people and go out here the same. You're lying in bed and you hear a word and you go, remember that church. You look at the movie list in Extra Vision and you see a list of the movies. Remember that sermon. Remember this. God is at work, my friends. But this morning, I haven't got Leonardo to preach for you. But I have someone from this part of the world, South Africa, who actually has been to these areas in South Africa as a soldier. And Paul Alexander he's been many things. I remember hearing Paul preach about a year or so ago to leaders in the Assemblies of God, leaders meeting. And he spoke about being in airplanes, little airplanes, going to mission fields. And he's been a missionary, he's been a pastor. And he's been in England for a long, long time. But now he's the principal of the Bible College, the Assemblies of God Bible College in Mattersea in England, the college that myself and Rob is attending, which we just completed our first year of our master's degree. I want to tell you guys, when them 3 years are over, I want an award. I want one for me and my wife and my kids. But it's a privilege to have Paul Alexander preach to us this morning. Paul's over here. He's doing some work with the master's degree students in their own Bible college here. And guys, let's give him a warm welcome to our pulpit. Paul.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to be here. And I've just enjoyed the whole sense of vibrancy and life and what God's doing and been really special sharing worship with you. Great, of course, to be with Noel and Rob, and they do deserve an award. I think maybe you deserve an award for sending them off, but I think it's a fantastic thing when Christian leaders commit themselves to upskill and do more and stretch themselves and grow and learn, and certainly for us to have them doing a master's degree with us in leadership, that's just a really special thing, and great to be in their situation. They're with us pretty much four or five times a year, and so it's really special to be with them. I just flew in from America yesterday, where my wife and family still are, and if there's a bit of a sort of afterglow, I became a granddad for the first time 3 months ago, and that was really special. And so it was just that much harder. I'm sure that the Atlantic grew just by a few miles with us leaving a little grandbaby behind. We have a little granddaughter called Ava. She's our daughter's daughter, and we've just had a wonderful 2.5 weeks. And in Ireland now for about 3 days, we have a group of students down in Greystones. But this is a special privilege and a great joy, and thank you so much for having me minister to you today. I trust you'll go home today saying, I'm really glad I found myself in God's house. And that God's spoken to you and given you something that you can live by and something that will really help you. I want to base what I have to say out of an Old Testament part of the Bible. It's Genesis chapter 22. Now, I noticed when the invitation was given that a whole lot of hands went up and said, you've been in church for 3 years or less. That is fantastic. Those are the best kinds of churches to be in, where people are constantly finding Christ and finding new life. What a wonderful thing. And so I'm not going to presume that you know all that much about the Bible. So let me just share a few things around this part of the Bible that I hope will help you and inform you and give you a foundation from which you can make good decisions for the rest of your life. Genesis chapter 22 is a very ancient part of the Bible. We don't have time for me to read it all today, but I want to base what I have to say on the first 19 or 20 verses. It's a very famous story on Abraham, who's sometimes known as the father of the faithful or the father of faith, and his son Isaac. And if you know anything about this part of the Bible, Isaac was a son of promise. God had promised Abraham that he would give him offspring. And, And then this dramatic day comes in Abraham's life where God says to Abraham, I want you to take Isaac, your son, your only son, whom you love, and I want you to sacrifice him to me. I want you to prove your obedience to me. I mean, a dramatic thing, a huge thing in the life of this father who God was directing and leading. And the story tells us how they traveled for 3 days and they went up the Mount of Moriah. And the very dramatic moment where as he was about to plunge the knife into his son's chest, God stopped him and said, Abraham, now I know you love me. And there was a ram that was caught in a thicket just a little way to the side. And instead of sacrificing his son, God asked him to sacrifice that ram. And we have this very amazing, dramatic, full of drama story right in the early part of the Bible. And because it's in that part of the Bible, I thought it would have some really good lessons for us to learn. Let me just help us get there by telling you a little story. It's a true story. Down in the southern, very southern states of America, in what's known as the Mississippi Delta, states like Mississippi and Alabama, it's still common today to have very poor farmers. They're called crop share farmers. They normally have a couple of acres of land, and they eke out a living off the land, do their very best. And one of these men was a man by the name of Bobber Johnson. Bobber Johnson had a few acres, and he would farm the land as best as he could, and normally just have enough for him and his family. Every now and again, he would produce enough food, not only for himself and his family, but actually to go and sell and get a little bit of cash on the side. And because he was such a poor man, all he had was a horse and a donkey and a cart. And so he would load up the cart and hitch it to the donkey, and he'd get on the horse and they'd go off to the nearby town and he'd sell the little bit of extra produce that he had. One day he was doing this as he had done many times before, and he was crossing an intersection, had no idea how it happened or where it came from, but a huge truck came down, smashed into him, his horse, his donkey, his cart, sent them all flying in 100 directions, and he fortunately survived the accident. Sometime later, there was a court case to try to settle what had actually happened, who was at fault. And they convened the court, and the judge was there, and the various lawyers for the two sides were there. And at a given moment, they opened the door, and they actually wheeled Bobber Johnson into the court. His leg was out in front of him in a brace, and he had bandages around his head, his arms were up in slings, and he was obviously in a really bad shape. And as he walked into the court, the defense attorney for the truck driver stood up to his feet and shouted at the top of his voice, Your Honor, this is a big put-on. This is to manipulate the court. This man's trying to already get the outcome that he wants. And he picked up a piece of paper. He said, I've got the police report from the accident site. And he said, in this police report, Mr. Johnson's own words are, when asked, how are you, Mr. Johnson? He said, fine, thank you very much. And now he arrives at the court looking like this, trying to manipulate the outcome. Well, the judge wisely asked them all to come forward to the bench, which they did. He leant over. He said, Mr. Johnson, is it true that at the accident site, when asked how you were, you said, fine, thank you very much? Mr. Johnson said, yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what I said. He said, however, you must take what I have said in context. He said, after that terrible accident, while we were lying scattered around the accident site, the police arrived. And when they arrived, the policeman went up to my horse. My horse was very badly injured. Its legs were splayed out, had blood coming out of its nose and ears and eyes and mouth. And feeling really sorry for the horse, the officer drew his service revolver, bam, shot him dead, right on the spot. He went over to my donkey. My donkey was equally as badly injured, bleeding badly, bones broken, feeling very sorry for the animal, bam, he shot it dead, right on the spot. He said, Your Honor, with his gun still smoking, he came over to me. He said, how are you, Mr. Johnson? I said, fine, thank you very much. And you understand why, right? Exactly. Right. It's got to do with the context, got to do with where the story was told. The time and the place where a story is told has a huge impact on how you understand the story, what sort of meaning it has to you. And that's very true of the Bible. If you want to understand the Bible, you do have to spend time, perhaps over years, trying to understand why it was written, where it was written, who it was written to, what sort of time it was written in. You see, a lot of people have big problems with this part of the Bible that I've referred to, because they say, how can a loving God require the sacrifice of a child? I mean, that seems like a violent God, not a loving God. But you've got to understand, friends, this was an ancient time. In fact, on another timeline, Abraham would probably have been a Stone Age individual. He had just come out of rank paganism. All of his neighbors, as far as he knew, would sacrifice their children because that's how they appeased their gods. If they didn't have a good harvest, or if they needed more children, or if they wanted their sheep to have more baby sheep, then they would sacrifice, and often they would sacrifice children. So this is what came naturally to him because of the ancient prehistoric state of his faith. He didn't have any other part of the Bible. He didn't have the lovely Psalms that remind us of the faithfulness of God. He didn't have the law of Moses. He had never even known that Jesus was somewhere out on the horizon. He did not have a Bible, and so he served out of the ignorance of his situation. And when you start to understand that, you understand that actually it was totally different for Abraham. He was walking the very early stages of faith. This was primitive faith where God was speaking the earliest principles of truth. So I reckon if God's speaking the most primary areas of truth into this man's life, surely that's something that I can learn, because if I can get that right, then the rest of the journey will probably be a little bit easier as well. These are really foundational things that we need to learn. So having said that, I'm going to do just three simple things with you before we finish today. Probably the easiest little kind of message outline you'll ever have. Here's the first thing I want to do, if it's okay. I'm going to make some comments. I'll try not to preach. I'll try not even be very inspirational. I'll just make some comments, if that's okay. Just good things, little things that hopefully will help you to see how good it is to learn from the Bible, how you can learn from eternal truth, and just make some comments on the text. Sort of principles of unwinding what will help you in basically learning what the Bible has to say. Very caring people, they give you toilet paper while you preach. And then having made some comments on the text, if it's okay and we're still getting on all right, I'm going to ask you some questions. I mean, that'll be quite sort of close to the bone. Some real things about how you respond to these areas, and then we'll have some final thoughts as we go home. So does that sound like a pretty good and easy way to follow? Some comments, some questions, some final thoughts, and then we go home. Well, I've been promised a nice meal out, so I'm pretty well motivated to finish as well. Here are some comments that I want to make. First of all, this. Abraham said, or you see it right there in the early part of Genesis 22, if you've got your Bibles open, God spoke to him, and in response to God calling his name Abraham, the Bible says, Abraham said, here I am. Quite easy to read in the Bible. Kind of sounds normal and everyday. It sounds like the normal thing that we would do. Good morning, how are you? Good, you know, top of the morning to you, whatever it might be. You know, I live in a part of England. I hope there are not many English people here today. But the language in the part of the world that I live in is insipid. It really kind of gets to me. We have these feeble greetings in the north of England where you say, hi, how are you? You know, you're full of life. You're enjoying life. How are you? Not too bad. I mean, that really annoys me. I mean, people are alive, and the best thing they can say about life is not too bad. I had a student knock on my door. I mean, it's my door. It's not his door. It's my door. He knocks on the door. I open the door, and we've had sort of experiences that make me pretty grateful that I'm alive. And I said, good morning. How are you? He says, on my doorstep, not too bad. I said, I beg your pardon, young man. You will never again say on my doorstep that you're not too bad. You're young. You've got the call of God in your life. You're studying in the best college in the world. You're still alive. And the best thing you can say is not too bad. Give me a break. You see, friends, it's not a case of just making our way through life. What Abraham does here is something very deliberate. He says, Yes, God. The closest sort of way of translating this, it's almost like some lovely ancient African greetings that I'm familiar with. He says, see me. Take note. Not just, yes, here I am. Take note, God, I'm here. It's kind of standing to attention very deliberately. A friend of mine was very involved in mission in Southeast Asia some years ago. And those are the days where you still wrote letters before email came out. And he would write to leaders in Southeast Asia. And if you know anything about the culture there, you will know that a really big thing about the culture there is saving face. You just don't say no to anybody. And so he would write and he would ask various things. And the answer was always the same. Whenever it came back, the answer was always yes, yes. And he knew that there were some things that they couldn't say yes to. You know, I want £1 million. Yes, no problem. You know, whatever it might be. And so he became wise to it and he began to write and say, thank you for your response. Can I just check? And he would write like this. He said, do you mean yes, maybe, or yes, no, or yes, yes? And every now and again he'd get the response, well, it was yes, no, and he would say, thanks for the honest response. But actually, in the text here, if you understand the ancient language, when Abraham says, here I am, he says, yes, 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 yes. See me, God. Take note. I'm right here. Just a comment. Got it? Let me make another comment on the text. Here's the second thing that I just want to say. It's down in verse 5. Really interesting part of the text. The way I describe it is Abraham publicly attested to his faith. He was very public about his faith. He was with the servants, and he said to the servants something really strange. He said, please stay here with the animals. I and the boy will go over to worship. And then if you know the text, it says, and we will come back. Now, there seems something wrong there. It seems like a grammatical error, or maybe Abraham didn't have very good arithmetic, one or the other. I mean, if you think about it, if two of you go over and one is sacrificed, how many come back? Just one comes back, right? It should, we go over and I will come back. I don't know what was going on in Abraham's ancient mind. I really don't. I don't know what was taking place here. But I know that somewhere deep down in this man's ancient mind, he knew that God would never tease him. He knew that God would always be true. He knew that somewhere God had promised him that this son would be a son that would produce his offspring and establish himself in the earth. And so the God of heaven, who he came to know, would not let him down at this critical time. And he had enough confidence in that to actually verbalize it. We will go over and we will come back. I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but I know that somewhere he thought, God cannot fail me now. I'm going to obey God and God will come through. And so he said, we will go over and we will come back. Very publicly. It was an open declaration of this developing ancient faith. Just something worth noting. You got that one? Another little comment. Let me make one more brief comment. Here's a really important thing. Abraham had already learned that the character of God is more important than the acts of God. Now that's worth processing just for a moment, just as a comment. The character of God, in fact, always precedes the acts of God. They're climbing the mountain, him and Isaac, and as they go up, his son turns to him and says, Father, we've got this, the wood and we've got the fire, but where is the sacrifice? And Abraham turns around and he says, God himself shall provide my son. I mean, that was a huge, big statement for this man. Remember that everybody else who Abraham knew related to their gods on the basis of what their gods did. If their gods were angry, they would send storms. If their gods were angry, they would fail the crop. If their gods were somehow in a good mood and had added some nice new wine and some nectar, then they would do nice things. And so it was up to people to do things for their gods so that the acts of their gods would be good. In fact, that's how religion always works. Almost all religion. That's why people still do, you know, rosary beads and they climb up stairs on their knees and do all kinds of other superstitious things, because the whole deep concept in religion is we've got to make God happy. We've got to somehow appease our gods. That's how it is. But Abraham already started to know that's not how the God of heaven works. The God of heaven does not work, friends, because we do things or we don't do things. It's because he is eternal and loving and kind and gracious and full of favor. And already Abraham was learning that we do not relate to God on the basis of what he does. We relate to God on the basis of who he is. The character of God is more important than the acts of God. And Abraham, in his ancient way, was already starting to learn that. Okay, don't have to be blessed. I was just making some comments. We're getting on okay? You're understanding my accent? All right. I mean, if you've got trouble with my accent, please have great sympathy for me when I'm with you guys. And when you guys get talking, I wonder what language you're speaking. So, three little comments. You okay? Can I ask you some questions? Really, they're based on these three comments, so they start to get quite close to how you live your life. Here's the first question I want to ask you this morning. Can I ask you, are you in this place able to say, here I am? You know, in the Abrahamic sense of the word. Not sort of cross your finger, hope for the best, say a little prayer, and trust it'll all come out in the wash. That's not the way to live lives, friends. As I read the Bible, there's no room in the Bible for us to live our lives with some kind of superstitious, hope for the best kind of outcome. We live our lives knowing that God's favor is on us, and that God's turned his face towards us, and that God's got a plan for our lives, and he's made us to be the head and not the tail. He's got a future for us, and he's a God that intervenes and gets involved. And when God comes into our lives, he's looking for us not just to go with the flow and hope for the best, but to get up in the morning say, here I am, God. See me. Take note. Please, God, let your will collide with my life. Don't go past me, God. Don't miss me, God. I want you, God, in my life. Here I am. Is that how you live your life? Confident, passionate, faith-filled, deliberate, getting into the purposes of God, engaging God, saying, please, God, don't go past my life. I want you to encounter me, and I want to encounter you. So, God, you need to know, here I am. By the way, that's one reason why we actually have worship in church. Maybe you haven't processed that before. We don't worship, friends, just because it's nice to do some communal singing. They could do that in any pub on any street corner. We worship because we create the opportunity for us one and all together to become committed, passionate, involved. And there's something potentially damaging to your soul when you don't get involved in worship, when you sort of sit at a distance and say, oh, well, the drums were much too loud this morning. That's got nothing at all to do with it. It's got to do with your heart and your soul and saying, well, God, it's another day, another opportunity. I need you to come and touch my life today and passionately commit yourself to worship. That's why people engage worship, find themselves so much more functional in almost every part of their lives. People who get all out of joint and a bit upset and don't quite like the music or the words, or why are they choosing new choruses? Yet again, I only just got to know the old one. That's actually not the issue, friends. It's not whether you know the words. And there's some nice things about familiarity, but it's actually got to do with a heart attitude. Here I am. Is that where you're at this morning? Oh, I hope so. I really do. Here's the second question I want to ask you today. It's quite a forthright one. But is your faith public? I mean, is it 24/7? That's the point. You see, one of the great lies that have been perpetrated in our societies over the last 50 or 60 years, and it has ravaged especially Western Europe, but most Western societies, and it's now become a global thing. One of the great lies is driven by an extremely powerful force called secular humanism. It's taught in our universities. It's affected all of our social sciences. Our school teachers are raised on it. It's right into our schools. And one of the tenets of secular humanism is this, well, we've got human rights, and so because we've got human rights, we've kind of got to tolerate that people can be religious. So we've got freedom of religion. That's what they say. They say, it's okay. It's all right for you to be religious. That's fine. We don't mind if you're religious. However, there's one precondition to anybody being religious in our society. Keep it to yourself. Have you heard that sort of thing? It's all okay, but we don't want it in the schools. We don't want it in any public place. We don't want to open any kind of session of parliament or anything else in prayer. Religion is a private thing. Now, friends, religion was never intended to be private. There's nothing that binds human hearts together more than a common faith. And actually, as I read the Bible, everything about our faith ought to be that it informs and affects every part of our life. I eat my meals with gratitude. I raise my family with a commitment to God. It's a 24/7, 365 day a year, my faith dominates every part of my living. It's not only a private thing that I do once a week, it's everything in my life. So how it is with you? I know my wife's spoken a number of women's events here in Ireland, so some of you have heard her share, but 7 years ago, almost exactly, we got up just on another day. It was the 1st of July, 2002. And I don't have time to tell you the whole story, but our 22-year-old son, Jason, who's always filled our lives, he came out of the womb running. He's been one of those kind of kids. And he was crossing an intersection just about a mile from our home. And we still, to this day, don't really know what happened, but as he crossed the intersection in his car, a huge big garbage truck. You know those big ones with the forklift at the front that lift the bins to the back? And it weighed 60,000 pounds, whatever that is in metric, going at over 100 kilometers per hour, and it plowed into the side of Jason's car. Forced his car against itself about a football field and a half down the road. That'll give you how much energy was in the truck. It was fully laden, literally sheared the wheels right off their axles. And then right at the end, there was still enough energy in that truck to flip up and come down right on top of the car and squashed it to the height of a shoebox on its side. And our boy was inside that car. maybe one day we should come and just tell you the whole story because it's filled with so many incredible miracles. But one of the first amazing things was that for some unknown reason, there was a first response medical crew that had parked their car right at the intersection, their van. And before the dust had even settled, there was somebody at our son's side. One of his injuries, amongst multiple injuries, was that his heart had literally been thrown from here down to this side of his abdominal cavity and back and had ruptured his aorta, which is the main artery exiting the heart. So it's like cutting the fuel line, really. And there's about a 1% survival rate. And one of his ribs back here, as his heart came back up, this rib crushed down and went right through the atrium of his heart and blew a hole about that size between the left and right ventricles, went through the other side of his heart and then ripped out, so like somebody put a dagger in his heart, and so on and so on. Just multiple injuries, major abdominal injuries. And they managed to airlift him to hospital, and our long, very long, and dark night started. At that point, we fought for his life every single day. He did not so much as move a finger for the first 3 weeks. I remember on about the 10th day was when they discovered that there was this extra hole in his heart. They didn't realize that the night they did the emergency surgery. And some little flakelets of blood had been breaking away from injury sites, and instead of going through his heart and out through the pulmonary artery into his lungs, these blood clots were going straight through his heart, shooting straight up the carotid artery. And that day, according to their means of monitoring it, he had had 3 strokes. And of course, that was bad news on top of bad news on top of bad news. And there was no way that we were going to go home that day without finding out more about what had happened to our son. I remember we waited and waited, and the doctor that we needed to see was doing some emergency surgery. We didn't see him until 11 o'clock that night. We were already exhausted. It was very clear that he was exhausted, but he was a professional, and so he agreed to meet with us. I remember we went back into this little room behind the trauma intensive care, and we sat down. We said, "Doctor, you've just got to tell us what's going on with our son." And I'll never forget the moment. He looked across at us, and he said this. He said, "Sir, ma'am," he said, "I have no faith. I'm not a man of faith. I'm a man of science. I do not believe in the supernatural. But I have to tell you that I was there the night they brought Jason in on the helicopter. I have no idea how they got him to us. I have no idea how we got him off the operating table. I have no idea how he's still alive to this day. All I can presume is that whoever you are praying to is doing a better work than what we've been able to do." And he said this. He said, "I suggest you go home and sleep well and leave your boy in the hands of whoever you're trusting his life to." Talk about the ungodly giving the godly counsel, you know. He gave us, and well, that's all he said. He couldn't tell us anything medically. He couldn't understand it himself. And Carol stayed behind. She was wiping her eyes and gaining her composure. I went out, and I stood at the nurse's station, and Jason's bed was right there because he was in such need. And he was on life support and respirator. By this time, he had a tracheotomy. And I remember just looking at him and, you know, this is my son, my heir. This is this boy who I've squeezed and loved, and we've seen him grow up so well. And, of course, you're overwhelmed with emotion. And while I was standing there, I remember the nurse next to me said, "Can I say something?" I said, "Yeah, sure." She said, "I just want to say thank you." I said, "What on earth for? You know, here we are receiving all the kindness. When you're in that sort of situation, you say thank you to everybody else, not the other way around." She says, "Well, I don't know how to say this." I said, "Well, say it anyway." And I'll never forget this little tear welled up in the corner of her eye. She said, "It's just been so different since you all have been here. Just, we can't wait for you to come and visit. We see the way that you touch him. I notice the way you speak into his ear. We just notice everything that's going on. And it's had such an impact upon us that we're all getting on better as a team. The whole atmosphere has changed. And I just really wanted to say thank you." And then as she said it, this tear rolled down her cheek and she pointed to her file. She said, "And for some unknown reason, our records are showing that people are getting better quicker than what they have before in our ward. It's just been so different. I wanted to say thank you." And I thought to myself, God, you're amazing. So amazing. As far as I know, friends, I never took my Bible. I never had enough energy to carry a big Bible into that ward. You know, our lives were stretched. I looked down at my arms the third day. Literally, the nerve ends on my arms had exploded. I come out in this rash. We went through one bit of bad news after another. It was extremely traumatic. And yet somehow in it and through it all, God was there. God was allowing the faith that we had developed over so many years to make itself obvious. There was something that came through. I don't know what. It wasn't a put on. It wasn't a show. We had no energy to be spiritually brave. And yet people noticed that there was a difference about our lives. And I can only thank God for that. Let me just rush ahead very quickly because this is where I normally let everybody down at the story. On the 21st day, Jason woke up. And it was quite a remarkable thing as he did. And they had lost critical supply. He had 7 blood transfusions in the first 13 hours, plus plasma and frozen platelets and all the rest. That's huge, 42 units of blood. That should have killed him. But when they did the surgery, they couldn't get any blood into his spinal column, so they thought he would be paralyzed. And 2 a.m. in the morning, there was a little Christian nurse on his bed, and he opened his eyes. She said, "Jason, can you hear me? If you can, pull out your tongue." And he pulled out his tongue. And now this is really important, Jason. If you can hear me, can you wiggle your right finger, left finger? He did both of those. And by this time, she said, all the rest of the people in the ward were gathered around. "Now, Jason, can you wiggle your right toe?" And he wiggled his right toe and left toe. And he wiggled his left toe. And she said, there wasn't a dry eye. I mean, these are people who deal with extreme cases of trauma all the time. She said, we were all crying together. And then under remarkable circumstances, and I'll save it all for another day maybe, just about 6 weeks later, we took our boy home, and they told us he would never live. Well, he lived. And then they told us he would never read, and he read. Then they said he had never studied. He went back to university, finished his degree about 2 years later, and he's actually now working and living in Hollywood, and he's in some of the movies that you've seen up on the screen. He had quite a big part in the last Tom Hanks movie, The Angels and Demons, and so he's actually working in the movie industry. My son, how he did that, I don't know. The point I make, friends, is that you don't know what life's going to throw at you. But what you can know is that God is unbelievably faithful and incredibly true. And that if you commit your life to Him and you live your life for Him 24/7, it all just becomes one great demonstration of the faithfulness of God. I've been going to church since I was a 14-year-old, and we've been going every Sunday that we possibly can. And people say, oh, you must love church. Well, not all the time. You know, sometimes, oh, I've heard terrible sermons. You don't have that experience here, but some churches suffer that. And sometimes, I remember when I was a really young Christian, we used to sing these embarrassing songs. There was this one song we used to sing, Who on Earth Wrote It? I have no idea. But in those days, we didn't have a whole group of people. We had one person, and he would always wave his hands like this and lead us all as a choir. And this bird, this song had one line which says, we're as happy as a bird upon a tree. And we'd all sing, we're as happy as a bird. And then the song leader would go like this. And I can't believe it. The whole congregation would go, tweet, tweet. You know, oh. Oh, my word. And I think I invited my friends to go to that church. I have no idea how embarrassing. You know, tweet. Can you imagine all going to church? You know, tweet, tweet, the whole thing. I'll say this, friends. I'm glad for every time I did go to church. I'm glad for every time I sat and heard something said. Because as the Bible reminds us, line upon line and precept upon precept, here a little and there a little, God lays truths into our lives. And as a result, you live your life 24/7 to honor Jesus. One more question, and then we'll have some concluding thoughts. Here's a really tough question, really big one for you. Don't get intimidated by it. I'll try and explain it. I want to ask you today, are you theologically mature? Oh, that's a big one. You say, give me a break. I'm hardly mature in any part of my life, let alone theologically. You know, I'm only just started coming to. Actually, theology is not such an intimidating thought. The whole idea of theology is it's a kind of like a road map. It, you know, when I come to Dublin, I'm pretty much lost all of the time. You know, because I haven't lived here, I don't know. So I kind of know where one or two main streets are. I know where the motorways go. And as far as possible, I'll get wherever I go by staying on the main roads and going on to the motorways. But I don't know the back roads. But you who have lived in Dublin all your lives, you've got a very comprehensive roadmap of your city. In a sense, you will never get lost in the city. Even if you go down roads you've never gone down before, you'll go down some road, say, well, I've never been down here before. But you know, sooner or later, you're going to hit another main road. You'll see a landmark that you know. You don't feel lost in a place where you have a comprehensive roadmap in your head. And that's kind of how theology is. Theology is our roadmap of God. So some people have a very limited, immature roadmap of God. God's a big force in the sky that can't wait to get you. Some people, that's their roadmap of God. And so they live in fear. Is God going to get me today? Is God going to judge me today? Is God going to do something to me today? Other people start to discover that actually God is amazingly kind, and He's huge, and He's wonderful, and He's good, and He's everlasting, and He's forever, and His every intention towards me is good. And as I grow that theology in my life, I start to understand the character of God is much more beneficial in my life than even the acts of God. You see, Job said it this way. He said, God, even if you slay me, yet will I serve you, because I know you to be faithful, and I know you to be true, and I know you to be eternal. And I don't understand everything that goes on in life, but this one thing I know, I've committed myself to Him, and I love Him, and He loves me, and He will turn all things together for good in my life, and He will orchestrate the plans of God for me. You might not have learned this, but friends, you cannot have a rehearsal when it comes to life. There's no practice run. You can't just go out and kick the ball on the field just to check out how it's. Everything we do in life is first time round. And sometimes life has a way of doing things and throwing things at us that we couldn't have planned or couldn't have thought of. But for the woman and the man who loves God, we stand tall in every situation. And we say, this one thing I know, that which I've committed to Him, He's able to keep against that eternal day. Underneath of the everlasting arms, He sustains me and keeps me. God will see me through. this thing I know, He will bring me out rejoicing. Even if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For your rod and your staff, they comfort me. God, I know you to be true. We will go up the mountain, and though I can't see the sacrifice, I'm able to declare with my mouth with absolute confidence, the character of God will stand true and firm. God Himself will provide in this situation. And some of you need to get that into the fiber of your being and stand courageously and tall this morning. Say, thank God He's in control. He has come into my life and He will not fail me now. My God will see me. The character of God is much more dependable than even our sense of His acts in our lives. Are you theologically mature? If not, friends, I encourage you to take journeys as quickly as you can into understanding the richness of Scripture and the goodness of God. So, a couple of questions. Have we got time for a few closing thoughts? Just 2 or 3 minutes? You still with me? I mean, when I say nice things about God, you get all excited. When I start saying other things, you go quiet on me. But just a couple of closing thoughts. Here's the first one. God always looks for sacrifice and obedience. It's true. I wish I could say that nicer. I wish somehow you could, you know, be standing on your chairs right now and applauding and saying, yes, that's it. But actually, it's true, friends. Whenever you come to the work of God, you'll discover there's one currency, and that is sacrifice and obedience. And when we gave some honor this morning, I thought it was amazing and good and absolutely biblical that we honor people, first of all, for who they are, but also for just spirit of sacrifice and commitment and obedience. Because whenever it comes to my relationship with God, just as it began with Abraham, so it has continued through every generation of humankind, our interaction with God will always, always, always involve a level of sacrifice and obedience. And actually, you become more you and more fulfilled and absolutely fulfill your purposes more when you develop a simple commitment. God, here I am to serve you and your people with everything that I've got. That's as simple as it is, sacrifice and obedience. Here's the second little thought that I want to conclude with. The mountain of sacrifice, the mountain of sacrifice has always got two sides to it. See, here's Abraham and Isaac walking up this side of the mountain. All they can see is this side of the mountain. The fire, the wood, no sacrifice. They had no idea that simultaneously with their act of obedience and sacrifice, coming up the other side of the mountain was a ram in the purposes and plans of God. And it wasn't until they got to the top of the mountain that the provision of God was seen. But you've got to have both sides to the mountain. You see, I have people say to me all the time, we've got no stories. You know, we can't tell all these tests. Well, it's quite simple, friends. Climb a mountain. Just do something. Get committed to go out on the limb. Share something. Do something. Open your home. Take somebody a meal. Do some random, spontaneous act of kindness. Get on a missions trip. Get some kids into your home. I don't know what it might take, but I can tell you this, friends, as you start climbing the mountain, at that moment, God will send a ram up the other side, and you will be able to say at the top, on this mountain, God provided. That's what Abraham did. That's how it is to this very day. And then one last little thought. Small acts of kindness and small acts of faith lay foundations for generational blessing. Sometimes very small things. See, friends, there's a whole lot of our lives that we don't live for ourselves. In fact, as Christ follows, there's a big part of my life that is sowing into the next generation. I have to plant trees that I will never sit under. I tell you why I want to live right. I tell you why I want to serve right is because I've got a son and a daughter and a son-in-law who I love intensely, and now I've got a little grandbaby too. And my life is rich, and I'm grateful for God's goodness, and I want them to grow up with a great sense of faith in the God that I've loved and served. I want them to live full and happy lives. And so small acts of sacrifice command generational blessing. You might be blessing generations you'll never see by just doing the right thing in this church now as you honor God. Lots of thoughts, lots of ideas, little things that have got to your heart. It's been my privilege to minister with you this morning. And I pray God's amazing blessing over you. Faithfulness, fruitfulness, goodness, and grace. May the God who we've honored and served today be your God too. And may He give you all the desires of your heart. Thank you for having me. Great cheer.
That was brilliant. Thank you, Paul. You know, there was a lot of inspiring and perspiring through that message. And really privileged to have Paul here.